Thanks for joining Current State today. We're glad you're along here on Friday, a fact that has not been overlooked by anyone that I've come into contact with so far today. Every single one, we're batting 1,000% here today. Friday awareness is through the roof. Current State's Election 2013 coverage continues today with a look at all the East Lansing City Council candidates. And there are quite a few. There may be some faces here that, and names that you'll be looking at on Tuesday the 5th that you're unfamiliar with. Well, stay close. Scott Pohl and Kevin Labrie sort the candidates out and sort out the issues for us coming up in just a little bit. And later on Current State today, we'll also speak with the founder of the Meltwater Movement. The Meltwater Movement is a local media group looking to make Michigan music more accessible. They promote Michigan music and Michigan bands. So, and throughout the show, we'll also be featuring music from Michigan artists who have been featured by the Meltwater Movement. So it's all very interesting approach to making Michigan music more popular. So stay close for that. We hope you can. At the top of the program today, a new dispute involving Michigan's recently enacted right-to-work law unfolded this week. On Monday, Midland's Mackinac Center Legal Foundation announced it's taking action against the Michigan Education Association. The conservative organization alleges the MEA, which is a 150,000-member union, mostly representing teachers, did not allow 8 teachers who wanted to stop paying union dues to drop out. Miriam Chansky is a kindergarten teacher from Cooperville in West Michigan. She's the lead plaintiff in the case. She wants out of the teachers' union but was unaware of the August window, which was the only time she could opt out.
I definitely think that there is information withheld from us, and I think it was withheld for the reason of keeping members and keeping members against their will in some circumstances like my own.
Now, Michigan's union landscape changed back in March when Michigan became the country's 24th right-to-work state, making dues-paying optional for unionized workers. We're joined today by the director of the Mackinac Center Legal Foundation to talk about the action. We need to make two other things clear. Number one, Current State invited the Michigan Education Association to participate in this segment as well. They declined, saying they respect the process whereby the charges will be heard in front of the Michigan Employment Relations Commission. They say that is where they will litigate the issue. MEA spokesman Doug Pratt did, however, agree to join Current State next Tuesday. We also need to point out that many WKAR employees are represented by the Michigan Education Association. That said, we welcome Patrick Wright, director of the Mackinac Center Legal Foundation, to Current State. Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
You have filed separate unfair labor practice complaints on behalf of 8 Michigan teachers claiming they were unable to withdraw from the union or stop paying dues. What are you saying happened here?
Essentially that the union is making a claim that is incorrect. They are claiming that they have this continuing membership requirement and that the union's constitution and bylaws trumps state law, that people are only allowed to withdraw from the month of August. Compounding matters is the fact that the union didn't tell anybody about this. There has been a recent law change which prohibits school districts from assisting unions get their money, so that the union are supposed to collect their own dues from their own members. And so the unions have been running around trying to get people to sign up for what they call e-dues, which is this process by which that you can either give them your bank account or credit card, and they will take them out as a monthly charge. Well, during this entire process, which has been going on at least since May when the Sixth Circuit upheld the law that said you couldn't have school districts participate in the dues withdrawal process anymore, the unions have been trying to gather this money. Well, right to work has been the law since March. And one would think that during this whole period that the unions might have mentioned the application of right to work during this time period and their belief that if you wanted to exercise right to work, you must do so during this August window. None of my clients heard a single word about it. We don't think that the August window prohibits it, but That's what the unfair labor practice charge is, because what's happened now is the MEA does, and it is threatening these people with lawsuits and to ruin their credit if they don't give up the $1,000 a year.
Now, earlier this year, what did you know about how the union would process member requests to stop paying dues? Did you explore that? Did you assume that the August window had morphed into something else?
I had looked into the question of the application of right to work. We put out some stuff telling people to be ultra safe. They needed to file things in order to get out, to make sure, and that, you know, resigning from the union was the safest way to make sure you could get to right to work. We sent out 30,000 emails. Somebody that we were associated with sent out emails. They asked us for some help. And so that happened in August. But, you know, there's 150,000 people. The MEA did nothing regarding this. And so we got to some people, but not to everybody.
So in a nutshell, you are claiming that right to work has rendered the August window, what, inadequate?
Yeah, the August window, first of all, should never have been allowed to stay in place. This before we had right to work, there are people, the most that somebody who didn't want to be associated with the union could do was under the First Amendment, they could become a fee payer. And what that meant was the Supreme Court had said that people didn't have to give political money to the union. They would have to pay for the unions, for a portion of the union's collective bargaining and for its grievance administration, but the money that the union used on politics, and the MEA, remember, is gathering close to $100 million a year, that they didn't have to give the union money for that. A gentleman wanted to become a fee payer. He wanted to become a fee payer immediately. America initially allowed him to become a fee payer immediately. At the time, the gentleman only had $30 that was at stake, and so when the MEA appealed it to the Court of Appeals, he was already out of the union by that point, and he didn't care anymore. So without taking any briefing or thoughts from the other side, the Court of Appeals looked at the decision Merck had made and said, you know what, you didn't make the decision for the right reasons. We're going to kick this back down to Merck. And when it came back down to Merck, the composition had changed to a more labor-friendly group, and they decided that they were going to say that the August window, the union's administrative needs, trumped this man's First Amendment ability to get out as soon as he wanted. Again, he was out at the time, and so there was just kind of left there. That was never appealed again to the Court of Appeals. It's been sort of the status quo for a while. And so that decision, we think, was wrong as applied to fee payers, and we certainly think that the right-to-work law would change whatever dynamics there is. There's also another case from the United States Supreme Court, which came out last year, which indicated that they believe that they're concerned about this thing called opt-in and opt-out. And essentially, the unions make these fee payers, and again, I'm switching from fee payers from right-to-work. It's a little bit different question. But they make these fee payers opt out every single year. You say, I don't want anything to do with the union. The union presumes that the next year you must still want to give them full dues. So unless you fill out all the paperwork again, then you have to do all of this. And the Supreme Court said, you know, why are we allowing this? It was in the context of a different case. But they said, you know, we've been looking at this for 40 years. We don't know how this developed. And essentially announced that they would be willing to accept cases that challenged this whole concept.
Okay.
So when you look at those two things, we think it's pretty clear that this 2004 decision was wrong even then, and it certainly is wrong when applied to right to work, and therefore the union going around telling people, like Ms. Chansky, that they're going to ruin her credit rating if she doesn't give them $1,000 is an unlawful threat and intimidation, which is prohibited by Michigan's Public Employment Relations Act.
The MEA's Doug Pratt, as I pointed out, will be joining us next Tuesday. He declined to join in this segment here today, but he did share one other comment with me yesterday. He called your action, quote, a baseless rehashing of a case already decided by Merck, that's the Michigan Employment Relations Commission, more than a decade ago. Is it clear what Merck has decided here?
That was the decision I just discussed to you that was wrong for the reasons that why it was wrong. Mr. Pratt knows that this isn't baseless, otherwise he'd be on your show right now. And quite frankly, when one looks at the MEA's response, they're a $100 million a year bully that's threatening teachers. And the fact that they're not engaged in the public relations battle means that they're kind of hoping that this thing blows over. This is an entity that is one of the most powerful political actors in the state. And yet they have chosen, in this case, power over principle, money over their membership, and cash over their colleagues. They think that it is so important for them to get this money that they are going to withhold valuable information from their own membership.
I don't want to get too far off this situation with the MEA, but how is this new right-to-work option being handled by other Michigan unions? Do they have an equivalent of the August window, or?
Yeah, the National Right-to-Work Legal Defense Fund is actually, there's a Teamsters bus driver that they are representing out of Howell that is a very similar case. I believe they filed the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation also filed a similar case about a paraprofessional, but I believe that she is MEA. So all of the public sector unions have these withdrawal windows. Now, what's interesting about the MEAs is that they claim theirs is for administrative reasons, that they have to have it in August for budgeting and so forth. Some of the other public sector unions throughout the states just do it as a one-year anniversary. So, we don't think that with Ms. Chansky, what was interesting was she tried to get out in May. And Steve Cook had sent out a letter right after Right to Work passed that we got a hold of and we put on our Capital Confidential news source. And in this letter, Cook says, we're not going to take any people who try and withdraw before August, and we're not going to take any people after August. So they either have to hit August absolutely correctly, or we're not going to allow it. So, you know, what is the point of not allowing people who've made it clear that they want to get out in May, like Miriam Chansky did, from withdrawing? What's the point of it? Well, the point is to try and erect as many obstacles as you can in order to keep those people in order to take their money. MEA may very well dislike this law. I know that it dislikes this law, and it feels that this is an improper thing, but it is the law, and they are misleading their own membership in order to try and get more money.
We're just about out of time. Just talk to me briefly about the larger response to your announcement this week, to your action this week.
Well, it has done what we expected, and that is there's a lot of people that are very interested in what's going on here. Again, the MEA, as we all know, is one of the most important political actors in the state, and the fact that they have some of their own membership who are feeling that they violated the golden rule, who were misled and deceived by their own union, has obviously led to a lot of interest throughout the state, and quite frankly, we're starting to get some national interest as well.
Patrick Wright is the director of the Mackinac Center Legal Foundation. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. I appreciate it.
Sure.
You think to tell me who I am, but you don't know me well at all. Hide your head. And turn your back against the wall. And turn your back against the wall. And la da 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 da.
That was the Barred Owls, a folk band out of East Lansing, with their song No Tracks. The Barred Owls have worked together with the Meltwater grassroots movement, and we'll learn more about that effort to promote Michigan music and Michigan artists a little later on in the show. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The MSU Symphony Orchestra's next concert is tonight at Wharton Center. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with both of the conductors who will lead the concert, starting with MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Noe. The program begins with Beethoven's Second Symphony.
Well, it's tasty and it's difficult. This is unique, I think, in Beethoven's output. For whatever reason, historically, it has probably been the least performed of the symphonies. I think there's no debate that Beethoven is the great symphonist of all time, and all nine are these sort of cherished things, and so they all get some due. I'm not saying the second never gets played, but compared to something like the fifth or the third or the ninth or even the first, it doesn't get done. Part of it is because I think, well, first of all, part of it is because it's just difficult. It's actually really quite tricky. And because it doesn't wear its grandeur on its sleeve the way the fifth does or something, you know, it might be a little less worth it somehow. It feels like it's not worth so much trouble. It also feels a little stuck in a certain kind of way. I don't mean to sound overly critical of the piece, but, you know, you think of the First Symphony, and it has this wonderful and very famous opening where he's trying to change the rules, and I'm going to be bold, you know, and I have less hair on my head, and I throw soup at people, and, you know, it's got this sort of grit to it. And yet it feels like, you know, it feels like classical music, but something is definitely changing. I think after he'd sort of gotten that proven, there's something in the Second Symphony that feels like a return to classicism, but he sort of can't let it go. So while I think the piece is difficult, I think it's definitely worth it, but I think that you have to listen with a different kind of ear to the Second Symphony. It really is a unique little slot between 1 and 3. Once you hit 3, you know, things start really changing. I mean, it really just runs like horses to the barn after that point. 2 seems like a little classical gem that I think doesn't often get done at the level that it should.
One of the critics described it as a writhing serpent that just won't die. Why do you think that might be?
Well, again, I think they must be. Well, did they dislike the piece? And was that
at the time? Yeah.
Oh, at the time. Well, you know, back then, what can you say? I don't know. I don't feel there's anything really particularly gnarly about the thing. But again, it's just tricky. You know, these little gestures that you hear that sound like nothing, it turns out that the execution of these things are really quite difficult. The last movement, for example, this thing is impossibly difficult to play. You know, the poor string players, I feel like taking a fire extinguisher and hosing down their fingers at the end of the exposition each time, you know?
And then something completely different, we get into the Ray Vaughan Williams Fantasy on a Theme of Thomas Tallis, which I'm a little biased on because it happens to be one of my favorite things. But it's unusual in a couple of respects, not the least of which is how the orchestra is set up.
Yeah, this is a piece that's very close to me personally. I'm absolutely madly in love with this work, and I've done it a couple times. It was composed after a period in which Vaughan Williams studied with Ravel for some orchestration help, right? And it's interesting, you know, you think of Ravel, the great orchestrator, and he does all these wonderful colors with the orchestra, makes use of every single instrument, you know, additional percussion. Everybody's making these marvelous sounds, all of which you can hear, much like Debussy. Ravel maybe even took it a little further. And Vaughan Williams, after having this experience with him, then chooses as his first orchestration piece an all-string work with no extra sounds to be found anywhere. And that, in fact, I think is actually its strength, because it is absolutely amazing the level of color and depth that you can get in the hands of a great composer with just strings. Now, the piece, unfortunately, I must say, is often played in a kind of one-sided way. It's just sort of warm, you know, and it's really pretty. And so you think, oh, I just love to hear strings just play, you know. And that's great, but the piece is better than that. And if you really work at it, there is an almost unlimited color palette to be explored. So he takes, for example, the whole string orchestra. So you maybe have 60 people, something like that, on stage, you know, full string section. So you hear the whole orchestra play a lot. He also has an offstage orchestra, which you're alluding to before in terms of the way it's set up. So he has a smaller string subset of about 10 people that are called the Orchestra 2 that are designed to be placed in it somewhere else. So in the Wharton Center, we're putting them up in the balcony as far away from the stage as we can get. So it's a little 10-voice string choir that plays up there. And then he makes use of string quartet on stage, so the principal players within the main string orchestra, they get a chance to play as a quartet. And then he breaks up each one of those, and there are 4 separate solos. So every possible combination of strings that you get, and each one of those within their own sort of phylum uses a lot of different colors to express this. And I find this just a breathtaking piece, because it's interesting that he's done this very modern thing in the way he's approached all these colors and broken it up with a very traditional means and used this old tune by Thomas Tallis as the way to get this done. And I think the piece is just endlessly fascinating and worth an enormous amount of rehearsal and work to really make it sing. I absolutely love this work.
It's interesting because it's such a passionate work, and yet I have not been able to find really anything that would be an inspiration or something he was thinking about or something that was going on in his life. At least the internet seems somewhat devoid of any information about what was moving him while he was writing this. All we know is that he, as far as I can tell, is that he came back from studying with Ravel and put this together.
Well, you know, I think sometimes that can happen. Sometimes you can start off, I mean, one of these great creators can start off with something that seems like an experiment in color or whatever. You see this in an art museum a lot. You know, you go and you see a painting and say, oh, I was experimenting with this and that and the other and blah, 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 blah. But then you look at the thing and the final product is this masterwork that you can't believe could have begun with such humble means, you know. I think this is no exception. I mean, I'm sure he also wanted to write a great piece, you know, but maybe he just thought, what can I do with strings? And then he had this idea, well, you know, let's just do this Thomas Tallis thing. Let's see what happens. So, you know, humble means magnificent ends, you know.
We're going to switch gears here and talk to the other conductor for this program.
My name is Matt Forte, and I'm getting my master's in orchestral conducting here at MSU.
And you are conducting?
I am conducting Fountains of Rome by Ottorino Respighi.
And what is it about this piece? It's a very visually descriptive piece. What do you think will pull the audience in?
The interesting thing to me about the piece is not only that it's so colorful, but that it's so literal. Respighi authors a 4-paragraph-long description of the piece at the beginning of the score. And he wrote this, I think, before he wrote the piece. And the most amazing thing is that almost every word in this description has a direct musical quotient. So that, for example, in the second section, he talks about mermaids and tritons playing amongst jets of water. You can hear the jets of water.
And the mermaids and the tritons.
Indeed. So it's very appealing in that way.
What have been some of the challenges that you think the players have faced in this piece?
It's kind of elusive for the players because the composite effect of the piece is brilliant, but individual lines are kind of tough to grasp. So you have a bass trombone player, for example, or a tuba player, who rest for the first half of the piece and then play something for 3 minutes that is mind-bogglingly hard and then don't play anymore. Or you have a trumpet player who comes in with just this incredibly difficult lick and then 80 measures of rest, and then another incredibly difficult lick. And so for a player, at first, it can seem somewhat elusive. But again, when you stand in a hall and take in the whole, it's absolutely amazing. And the method and intellect with which Respighi executes these various gestures is absolutely astounding.
That was guest conductor Matt Forte, and before that, MSU Orchestra's conductor Kevin No. They spoke with Current State's Melissa Benmark. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The Virge Bernero re-election campaign reportedly has until October 31st to respond to charges that the Lansing mayor and two campaign aides illegally funneled money to Kathy Dunbar's city council campaign. Three complaints altogether, according to the Lansing State Journal's Kristen Daum. Now, according to the story, the mayor's accused of giving, quote, uncharacteristically high, unquote, salary payments to a pair of contract employees working on his campaign. A few days later, the employees donated money to the Dunbar campaign. Now, the mayor says he doesn't believe a mistake was made, but says he's cooperating with the Secretary of State and will respond accordingly, depending on what the Secretary of State determines. The results apparently won't be learned until after the election, so who knows what impact that this may have on the voting. Mayor Bernero joins us, by the way, here on Current State. Next Wednesday, we'll ask Virge Bernero about this situation and about other issues in the re-election campaign and city biz next Wednesday here on Current State. For now, we continue our election 2013 coverage today with a look at the race for city council in East Lansing. There are four candidates for full terms on the council, and an appointee to the council has a challenger for the right to fill the balance of one term. Current State producers Kevin Lavery and Scott Pohl join me today to report on the November 5th election in East Lansing. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To see you. Scott, let's start with you. You spoke with the city manager and an outgoing member of the council about the challenges facing the next East Lansing City Council.
That's right, Mark. Now, with two and possibly three departures from the five-member council, I thought I'd try to learn more about what that might mean in terms of a loss of experience. East Lansing has a city manager form of government, and there's no change there, but I wondered about how the role of the council might be affected. Kevin Baird was first elected to the council in 2005 and re-elected in 2009, but he chose not to run for another term. He told me that before looking forward, you have to look back at years of budget cuts.
We have already cut the workforce by a quarter over the last decade. Almost all of that reduction in employees has been done through normal attrition. There's only been a couple situations where we've had layoffs. We have just as many firefighters on the trucks and just as many cops on the street. What we eliminated were middle management type positions in the force. So we're not really seeing a reduction in services from DPW or police or fire public safety areas, but we've been trying to figure out how to do more with less. And every single department in the city is staffed smaller than they were a decade ago.
Baird says that while shrinking the city workforce through attrition has helped, other difficult decisions have had to be made.
The other tough things we've had to do is defer some of our public infrastructure improvements and delay that. But what I foresee in the next 2 to 4 years is our revenues stabilizing and starting to increase, and a chance to pick up on some of that maintenance that we have deferred.
City Manager George Lahanas says East Lansing is facing the same problems towns all over Michigan are confronting, and they're all related to lower property tax revenues and reductions in state revenue sharing.
Obviously, communities in Michigan have been struggling also to fund properly the legacy cost issue. So this is post-retirement benefits that have been accrued to employees over the past 30 or more years. And then again, not surprisingly, if you drive on our roads in Michigan, is that the streets and infrastructure is in need of more investment in order to get it to a place where I think our residents and citizens in Michigan would be happy with that. So that's probably the best look at what we have to handle over the next couple of years.
With new faces a certainty on the council in 2014, East Lansing's city manager form of government could mean that a lack of institutional memory on the council will be negligible. Again, city manager George Lahanas.
The council role is to, from the biggest picture, set policy direction and appropriations of our dollars. But in the council manager form of government, there's a lot of continuity in terms of the city management staff, the senior staff, and the people who are doing the day-to-day jobs of preparing the budget, of delivering services. So our form of government is actually pretty well built to endure changes where there may be people who don't have that much history, but certainly the professional staff that will be providing them information have a pretty good long-term picture here. So our job is to put the city council in the best position to make decisions, and whether it's a new council after November or this council now, that's what our role is.
Kevin Baird agrees. He says most former members of the East Lansing City Council are a phone call away, something next year's newcomers should avail themselves of.
You know, we've got good candidates running, folks that have been involved in the city at some level and are concerned about it. Some have more experience on boards or commissions or neighborhood associations than others. But we really do rely on the staff and the city manager to do a lot of research and provide us with information on which we base our decisions.
Baird tells me that he's advised people before about the notion of serving on the council. His guidance is simple, with three specific points.
The hours are long, the pay is small, and your hands are tied most of the time.
Okay, well, from one Kevin to another, Kevin Lavery, you've been studying some of the dynamics of economic development and relationships between students and permanent residents in East Lansing.
That's right, Mark. Many communities have a perennial tug of war going on between their downtown business core and their neighborhoods. There's always debate about how and where to invest a city's limited resources. And as a college town, East Lansing is constantly trying to keep an inclusive and a harmonious relationship between its students at Michigan State University and permanent residents. Whoever gets elected to the city council will have to weigh all these factors to move the city forward. Right now, though, East Lansing planners are encouraging all of its stakeholders to take a step back and look at the bigger picture.
That's the name of the city's comprehensive planning process. Every 5 years, state law requires East Lansing to review its projected land use 20 years into the future. This time around, there's signs of new hope for a long-neglected parcel at the city's front door. Tim Dempsey spends a lot of time analyzing the city's plots and tracts. He's the director of planning, building, and development in East Lansing. He zooms in on a satellite map to a spot just west of downtown.
If you look at Valley Court Park, where we have our farmers market, right now we have this dead zone. And we need to turn this area into a lively connection, more inviting for pedestrians to come into the west end of downtown, and also for those who are taking advantage of Valley Court and the farmers market, as I mentioned, to come eastward into downtown.
Dempsey says more walkability downtown will create a level of density that urban areas crave to stay economically viable. But there are differing opinions about what should be built there. Chris Nichols is one of those residents who enjoys the Sunday Farmers Market in Valley Court Park. Like many, she's watched the stops and starts of the adjacent project once known as City Center 2. For years, the mixed-use concept suffered a long string of setbacks that ended last year when the city terminated its contract with the former developer. The multi-building site is now being remarketed as the Park District. Nichols would like to see more retail there, but not more residential.
Through the years, there have been several options for the different components of that project, hotels, public theater, restaurants, student housing. I think we feel that there's plenty of student housing, and we'd rather not see more of that downtown and the congestion it brings in terms of, you know, vehicles and students in the very city center.
Resident Stuart Binky is awaiting the Park District's resurrection too. He thinks it could brand East Lansing with an identity that's distinct from its largest tenant, MSU.
Certainly the university shapes us, but I think it has to have its own mark. It has to have its own personality and signature that it needs to bring to bear, separate from the university. Not in conflict with it, but certainly that complements it.
Other residents see East Lansing at a tipping point that threatens the strength of its communities outside the Grand River Corridor. Elliot Singer says it's time to reverse the economic policies of the last 20 years and stop subsidizing downtown development with costly tax incentives.
The neighborhoods are struggling. We have an aging population that's increasingly on fixed income, paying very high taxes. And if they're neglected, the city's going to continue to see property values in the neighborhoods decline, and the city will be in more and more trouble.
Those who view the neighborhoods as the true heartbeat of East Lansing want to ensure their interests are protected. That means maintaining the city's often envied array of public services and its school system. and it means building positive relationships between permanent residents and students. You might call that Citizenship 101.
You're learning how to become a member of a community when you're living off campus in the houses.
Ryan McCaffrey knows that membership from both sides. The MSU senior grew up in East Lansing. Now he's a second-year intern on the Community Relations Commission, a group that includes students living in the neighborhoods who conduct regular outreach. McCaffrey admits there's tension sometimes between students and residents, mainly nuisance complaints like loud partying. But he says students play a vital role in shaping civic life, and they need services too.
We got 40,000 permanent residents and 30,000 student residents, so being involved in the local politics is important because services like CADA and medical amnesty would never have happened if there was any sort of civic engagement from the students.
Erin Carter is MSU's community liaison with the city. She says those good connections continue even as individuals come and go.
Neighborhood associations that have had students participate and had those students be vocal and viable parts of their groups, even though the student might have graduated, have invited another student to take that place because they have enjoyed the voice that has been brought. And that has really served to continue to even open more doors.
Election cycles carry with them the promise of new blood and fresh thinking. Residents like Elliot Singer say that's what they want to see from their next city council members. Singer says East Lansing needs independent minds that won't simply rubber stamp bad decisions.
If we can get a majority that thinks that way and does their homework and listens to the community, that'll bring about the kind of reforms that the city needs after what we went through for 15 years under the previous city manager.
Okay, so let's learn more about the candidates for East Lansing City Council. Scott?
All right, Mark. Now, the incumbents who are leaving the council are Kevin Baird, who we heard from earlier, and Victor Loomis. Four people are running for those two seats, and the top two vote-getters will each serve for 4 years. Alphabetically, we'll start with Sam Artley. She's a consultant with Mitchell Research and Communications, and last year she managed the Andrea Andrews-Larkin campaign for district court judge. On her website, she says business development is a top priority, and she has expressed an interest in East Lansing's daytime retail operations in comparison to the focus many put on the city's nightlife. She also hints at improving lighting and adding patrols as needed in parts of the city. Next is Ruth Beyer, an economist with the Michigan Education Association. She also was a deputy state treasurer under Governor Jim Blanchard. She currently serves on the city's Downtown Development Authority. It's clear from her website that she hopes voters will decide that her work as an economist will make her a good steward of city finances. She wants to fight any further cutbacks to police and fire services, convert rentals to single-family homes, and improve the condition of the remaining rental properties. Ben Iselink is a project manager with the local Vertifor software company. He was a graduate of the inaugural class of the East Lansing Emerging Leaders Program. His campaign announcement touted his work in strategic planning and customer service. His work in technology fields, he says, will help the city find technology-based solutions to problems. He'd like to create a downtown Wi-Fi bubble as one way of promoting a sustainable, diversified economic base. Lastly, we have Susan Woods, a name many will connect with having founded the East Lansing Film Festival 16 years ago. In 2011, she received an East Lansing Crystal Award. She would like to bring more arts programming to the city, and she expresses an interest in monitoring the Park District development project. Voters can vote for two of these candidates, and as I said, the two with the most votes will win.
Okay, and Kevin, what can you tell us about the two candidates running to fill the balance of this unfinished term on the East Lansing City Council?
Sure. Well, Don Power resigned from the council just over a year ago, and Kathleen Boyle was appointed by the remaining council members to fill his seat. Now, if she wants to keep it, then she has to win an election in her own right to stay in office until November of 2015. Kathleen Boyle is an attorney with an Okemos firm and has represented the Michigan State Troopers Association. She said that the city's planning process must consider the concerns of neighbors and developers. In the Lansing State Journal, she recently expressed a desire to keep her council seat and stay the course. In her year on the council, Kathleen Boyle has been involved with reviewing city ordinances, and she wants to keep working on the Park District plan and the city's comprehensive plan update. Her opponent is Joanna Bossi. She is an ethnomusicologist and a dance ethnographer at MSU. She told the MSU campus newspaper, The State News, that taxes in East Lansing are high enough that families have left the city for other nearby towns where they can, and this is a quote, get twice the house for half the taxes. The LSJ has reported that she sees tensions growing between year-round residents and the MSU student population, even to a degree that's greater than she's seen in other college towns that she's lived in. She said she'd work on bridging that gap. One final note, Mark, the East Lansing does not delay seating council members after the election. The three winners will tentatively be sworn into office at the first meeting after the election results are certified, and that will be Tuesday, November 12th.
All right. Thanks very much, Kevin Lavery and Scott Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Days get nice, the nights get long. Pouring whiskey over ice. What more could we ask? Things that I forgot to say. Je t'amie, ma chérie. Now it's too late. Flowers bloom at an odd angle. When I used to, there's a screw loose in my bike, so you better look out. The bark on trees, prints of our fingers, the prints of friends, why does it linger? Must be all
that. Welcome back to Current State. That was Genghis Kayun, a Michigan-based group, with their song Sriracha on the Beach, which has been featured by our next guest. The Meltwater Grassroots Movement is a local media group that makes Michigan's music scene more accessible through photos, video, and audio. Artists in the Mitten State are featured on their various social channels with exclusive content unique to the Meltwater Movement brand. Here to talk with us today is the founder of the organization, Ryan Walsh. Ryan's a Michigan native who lived and worked in New York City until returning to the Midwest recently. He says he believes Michigan has a rich music history and unique music scene that has often been overlooked. Welcome to Current State, Ryan.
Nice to meet you, Mark.
I'm intrigued by your group's name, the Meltwater Movement. Where did that come from?
I was just trying to think of names that would try to encapsulate what Michigan is about. And I guess Third Coast, I was thinking Third Coast for a long time, but I guess the Third Coast is the Gulf Coast in the South. So I was like, the glaciers and the meltwater from the glaciers.
Sure.
Yeah, that's pretty much where it came
from.
The
Meltwater Movement. What's your goal with the Meltwater Movement?
For me, I want to make a difference in my community somehow.
An artistic difference.
Just a difference in general, I think. I think being in New York, it is much harder to make a difference when you're like a little fish in a big ocean, per se. New York was amazing, but I think coming back, I realized how fertile of a ground that Lansing and in Michigan is in general to grow something and to affect people there.
You're from this area originally?
I'm actually on the more East Coast side of Michigan, kind of Royal Oak, Southfield area.
Okay. Yeah. What brought you back to Lansing specifically?
I had the idea to do some kind of music live event shooting group in New York. And I know a lot of filmmakers here because I went to MSU.
Okay.
And so I thought, well, why don't I just keep to where I know and people that I know and kind of go from there.
As we said, you are the founder of the Meltwater Movement. What do you do on a day-to-day basis in the organization?
It definitely changes day-to-day. I kind of do...
It's like that when you found something, I guess.
Yeah.
You end up doing whatever is necessary, right?
Mm-hmm. That's basically it. I try to do every portion of it, from working with the artists, trying to find times and locations, working with business owners, trying to build the website.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, learning how to build a WordPress website and get it hosted, all that kind of stuff. Learning how to do proper social media etiquette and pretty much everything.
Sounds like this trip to New York, though, was really part of a process that, mm-hmm. that made you realize how much was going on back here. You moved to New York after you graduated from MSU. Tell us more about what happened in New York City.
Yeah, I think that's every college graduate's kind of idea, especially when you're in filmmaking. You want to move to LA or New York City and try to make it big or whatever. And I don't know, it's a bit of an endless ladder type syndrome where you get stuck being some production assistant working for free, and you're doing a side job, or you're doing two or three side jobs because it's expensive there. And I don't know, I guess while I was out there, I did have the chance to work on a few music events, and it kind of reinvigorated that sense of community and that sense of brotherhood when you're shooting something with a group of people and trying to coordinate an event. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. And it didn't necessarily work in New York, but I thought that I could take that concept and kind of bring it back to Michigan because it was something that I enjoyed doing and I thought other people would enjoy. Not sure if that answered your question.
It's also interesting how when you move away from a place to another place, uh-huh. how you begin to reassess where it was that you came from.
Yeah, that's very true.
It sounds like that kind of happened as well. Moving to New York made you, did it make you reassess what was going on back home?
It's kind of funny because I actually was born in New York, and I always wanted to go back there. I think there was just a little kernel of
unfinished business.
Unfinished business.
Yeah,
exactly. And one of my film professors actually, Jeff Ray, said that he always thought that I would do well in New York City for some reason. I don't know why. I think he thought I was kind of the indie. Kind of made weird experimental films, and so he thought I'd do well over there. Or maybe I was just a brash, harsh dude, and so he was like, oh, yeah, you do great on the East Coast. But, I guess it was kind of unfinished business. And once I got over there, it also, taught me how much of a Midwest kid I was, too. So it was definitely a self-learning moment.
Well, we're just glad you came back to Lansing as opposed to joining the parade to Chicago. we're just glad you're back here. Jeff Ray, by the way, is our film reviewer here on Current State.
No kidding.
We should also point that out. So the stars aligned on that. How do you find people to work with you?
People I've worked with on film sets and school projects before. Their friends, their acquaintances.
But it's my understanding they use their own equipment, and you really don't offer them any monetary compensation here.
Yeah, that is a kind of a big part of the whole movement is that there is no capital gain that's coming from it. It's not necessarily that we're opposed to being to getting money for what we do. It's more just that's not what the focus is. The focus mm-hmm. is on kind of building your community and. And keeping those other, extra incentives to the side. Hmm.
Now, going hand in hand with this, you don't charge bands for mm-hmm. creating this exclusive content of them, correct? Why is that?
It's just a trade, that we give them promotional content and content that they can use on, live EPs and whatnot from our recordings. And in return, they give us a spectacular performance for mm-hmm. people to listen to.
How would you describe Michigan's music scene since you've been back here doing this?
Yeah. It's all over the place, really.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, it is, actually. I really like that. I am myself a fan of pretty much any and every genre. And so it's really nice that getting to work with artists in more rock bands, you have more, folk artists, hip-hop artists, electronica artists. So it's nice working with all of them and listening to all their music.
On the show, we've been playing some live recorded versions of your songs, like this one from local artist Nathan Allen. Tell us about Nathan.
Nathan's a cool dude. His music's great. He's actually, I think he's roommates with our audio engineering wizard, Philip Beard. And so he's, the track that you guys are going to play is Nathan Allen, Broken Boards.
Here it is.
I drove the trail where you had picked flowers you put in your hair. Way after hours, and your ma wants you home, but you're out on the town and you're down by the lake. You made up a fire before the storm.
Well, Ryan, it's been interesting to learn about the Meltwater movement. We wish you all the best. It sounds very organic. It sounds just like something that's evolving as we go along. It's been a pleasure to meet you. Ryan Walsh is the founder of the organization, the Meltwater Movement. Best of luck.
Yeah, my pleasure, Mark.
That is our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we take a closer look at Lansing's marijuana ordinance. Also, we speak with one of the co-writers of the documentary, The War of the Worlds. That and more next week on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Instroth is Current State's producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.
Lady, and I got my name for running through tall trees and breaking some hearts, from lying with ladies.